but he was woefully out of place in the role. His tendency to indulge his moods became obvious one Sunday morning when a church service was being held. After some appropriately reverent prayers, the idea struck him to sing a few hymns, and he broke up the proceedings by clapping his hands and demanding impetuously, "Where's the ruddy band?" By the time the Endurance reached Buenos Aires on October the 9th, 1914, Worsley's lack of discipline had let morale slip to a sorry state. But Shackleton and Wilde had arrived from London, and they applied a firm hand. The cook, who had been an indifferent worker on the trip over, came aboard drunk and was immediately paid off. Amazingly, 20 men applied to fill the vacancy. The job went to a squeaky-voiced man by the name of Charles J. Green, who was a different sort of person altogether, conscientious almost to the point of being single-minded. Later, two of the seamen, after a stormy night ashore, tangled with Green Street and were similarly let go. It was decided that the complement would be adequate with only one replacement. The berth went to William Bakewell, a 26-year-old Canadian who had lost his ship in nearby Montevideo, Uruguay. He arrived with a stocky 18-year-old shipmate, Perce Blackborough, who was hired temporarily as the cook's helper during the Endurance's stay in Buenos Aires. Meanwhile, Frank Hurley, the official photographer, had arrived from Australia. Hurley had been on Sir Douglas Mawson's last expedition to the Antarctic, and Shackleton had hired him solely on the basis of the reputation he had achieved as a result of his work there. Finally, the last official members of the expedition came on board, 69 sledge dogs that had been purchased in Canada and shipped to Buenos Aires. They were kennelled in stalls built along the main deck amidships. The Endurance sailed from Buenos Aires at 10:30 a.m. on October the 26th for her last port of call, the desolate island of South Georgia off the southern tip of South America. She proceeded out the ever-widening mouth of the River Plate and dropped her pilot the next morning at the Recalada lightship. By sunset, the land had dropped from sight. Chapter 3. They were on their way at last, really on their way, and Shackleton was immensely relieved. The long years of preparation were over. The begging, the hypocrisy, the finagling, all were finished. The simple act of sailing had carried him beyond the world of reversals, frustrations, and inanities. And in the space of a few short hours, life had been reduced from a highly complex existence with a thousand petty problems to one of the barest simplicity, in which only one real task remained, the achievement of the goal. In his diary that night, Shackleton summed up his feelings. "Now comes the actual work itself. The fight will be good." Among some men in the forecastle, however, there was more a mounting air of tension than of relief. The crew list carried the names of 27 men, including Shackleton. Actually, there were 28 men on board. Bakewell, the seaman who had joined the Endurance at Buenos Aires, had conspired with Walter Howe and Thomas MacLeod to smuggle his pal, Perce Blackborough, on board. As the Endurance rose to the increasing swell from the open ocean, Blackborough half-crouched behind the oilskins in Bakewell's locker. Fortunately, there was a great deal to be done on deck, so that most of the forecastle hands were employed elsewhere, and Bakewell could periodically slip below to give Blackborough a bite of food or a drink of water. Early the next morning, the three conspirators decided their time had come. The ship was too far from land to turn back, so Blackborough, who by now was severely cramped, was transferred to the locker assigned to Ernest Holness, a fireman who was due to come off watch shortly. Holness arrived, opened his locker, saw 2 feet protruding from under his oilskins, and hurried back to the quarterdeck. He found Wilde on watch and told him of his discovery. Wilde immediately went forward and hauled Blackborough out of the locker. He was brought before Shackleton. Few men could be more forbidding than Ernest Shackleton in a rage, and now, squarely facing Blackborough, his huge shoulders hunched, Shackleton berated the young Welsh stowaway mercilessly. Blackborough was terrified. Bakewell, Howe, and MacLeod, standing helplessly by, never had expected anything of this nature. But then, at the height of his tirade, Shackleton paused abruptly and put his face up close to Blackborough's. "Finally," he thundered, "if we run out of food and anyone has to be eaten, you will be first. Do you understand?" A smile slowly spread over Blackborough's round, boyish face, and he nodded. Shackleton turned to Worsley and suggested that he assign Blackborough to help Green in the galley. The Endurance arrived at the Grytviken whaling station on South Georgia on November the 5th, 1914. Depressing news was waiting. Ice conditions in the Weddell Sea, while never good, were the worst they had been in the memory of the Norwegian whaling skippers operating in the area. Several of them predicted it would be impossible to get through, and some even tried to dissuade Shackleton from trying until the following season. Shackleton decided to remain at South Georgia for a time in the hope that the situation would improve. The whalers were especially interested in the expedition because their first-hand knowledge of the Antarctic seas gave them a very real appreciation of the problems Shackleton faced. Moreover, the arrival of the Endurance was an occasion at South Georgia. Ordinarily, there was very little in the way of diversion at this southernmost outpost of civilization. There were a number of parties on board the ship, and the whalers reciprocated with gatherings of their own ashore. Most of the crew were entertained at the home of Fritjof Jacobsen, the manager of the Grytviken whaling station, and Shackleton even made a 15-mile trip to Stromness, where he was the guest of Anton Andersen, the off-season factory manager there. While Shackleton was at Stromness, the regular factory manager, Thoralf Sørli, returned from his vacation in Norway. Sørli was a powerfully built man of 38, with dark hair and a handsome handlebar moustache. In his seagoing days, Sørli had been perhaps the best harpooner in all the Norwegian whaling fleet, and he had a vast knowledge of polar ice navigation. During the following month, Shackleton drew upon the experience of Sørli and many of the whaling captains to form an overall picture of the movements of ice in the Weddell Sea. In the end, this is what he'd learned. The Weddell Sea was roughly circular in shape, hemmed in by three land masses: the Antarctic continent itself, the Palmer Peninsula, and the islands of the South Sandwich Group. Consequently, much of the ice that formed in the Weddell Sea was held there, prevented by the encircling land from escaping into the open ocean, where it might have melted. The winds in the area were light by Antarctic standards, and not only failed to drive the ice away, but even allowed new ice to form at all seasons of the year, even summer. Finally, a strong prevailing current, moving in a clockwise direction, tended to drive the ice in an immense semicircle, packing it tightly against the arm of the Palmer Peninsula on the western side of the sea. But their destination was Vahsel Bay, more or less on the opposite shore. There was thus reason to hope that the ice might be carried away from that particular stretch of coast by the prevailing winds and currents. With luck, they might slip in behind the worst of the ice along this lee shore. Shackleton decided to skirt the northeast perimeter of the Weddell Sea and its evil pack, and hope that they would find the coast in the vicinity of Vahsel Bay ice-free. They waited through December 4th, hoping that the supply ship for the whaling station would arrive with the last mail from home before they sailed. But it didn't. So, at 8:45 a.m. on December the 5th, 1914, the Endurance weighed anchor and proceeded slowly out of Cumberland Bay. When she had cleared Bath Point, the command, "Sail stations," rang out. The mizzen, main, and foresails were set. Then the fore topsail and royal sail were braced before the freshening northwest wind. A raw, numbing mixture of drizzle, sleet, and snow was driving across the leaden sea. Shackleton ordered Worsley to set an easterly course for the South Sandwich Group. 2 hours after the Endurance had sailed, the supply ship arrived with their mail on board. The Endurance skirted the coast of South Georgia, running before a high following sea. The ship itself presented an appalling sight. 69 quarrelsome huskies were tied forward, several tons of coal were heaped on the deck midships, and up in the rigging hung a ton of whale meat for use as dog food. It dripped blood constantly, spattering the deck and keeping the dogs in a near frenzy of anticipation, hoping a piece would fall. The first land sighted was Saunders Island, on the South Sandwich Group, and at 6 p.m. on December the 7th, the Endurance passed between it and the Candlemas volcano. There, for the first time, she encountered the enemy. It was only a small patch of light stream ice which the ship negotiated without difficulty. But 2 hours later, they came up against a band of heavy pack ice several feet thick and half a mile wide. Clear water was visible on the other side, but it would have been extremely dangerous to push into the pack with the heavy swell that was running. So for more than 12 hours, they searched along the edge of it, until at 9 o'clock the next morning they found what appeared to be a safe passage, and they started through, with the engines at dead slow. Several times the Endurance smashed head-on into floes, but no damage was done. Like most of the others on board, Worsley had never seen polar pack ice before, and he was tremendously impressed by it, especially the excitement of dodging large floes. They passed a number of very large bergs, some of them more than a mile square, which presented a majestic sight as they rode the swell with the seas breaking against their sides and leaping high into the air like surf pounding against cliffs. The action of the sea had worn huge ice caverns in many of the bergs, and each breaking wave produced a deep booming sound as it rolled into one of these ice-blue caves. Also, there was the hoarse, rhythmic wash of the seas bursting against the graceful, undulating pack as it rode the steep swell. For 2 days they sailed east, skirting the edge of the pack, before they were finally able to turn south toward Vassal Bay at midnight on December the 11th. The Endurance twisted and squirmed her way through the pack for nearly 2 weeks, but it was progress of a stop-and-go sort. Frequently, she was barely able to push her way through, and sometimes she was stopped altogether and had to heave to until the ice loosened. In an open sea, she could make 10 to 11 knots without the aid of sails, and could easily have covered 200 miles a day. But by midnight of December 24th, her average daily run was less than 30 miles. Before leaving South Georgia, Shackleton had estimated that they would be ashore by the end of December. But they had not yet even crossed the Antarctic Circle, though the summer had already officially begun. It was now light, 24 hours a day. The sun disappeared only briefly near midnight, leaving prolonged, magnificent twilight. Often during this period, the phenomenon of an ice shower, caused by the moisture in the air freezing and settling to earth, lent a fairyland atmosphere to the scene. Millions of delicate crystals, frequently thin and needle-like in shape, descended in sparkling beauty throughout the twilight air. And though the pack in every direction appeared to stretch in endless desolation, it abounded with life. Finner, humpback, and huge blue whales, some of them 100 feet long, surfaced and sported in the leads of open water between the floes. There were killer whales, too, who thrust their ugly pointed snouts above the surface of the ice to look for whatever prey they might upset into the water. Overhead, giant albatross and several species of petrels, fulmars, and terns wheeled and dipped. On the ice itself, Weddell and crab-eater seals were a common sight as they lay sleeping. And there were penguins, of course. Formal, stiff-necked emperors who watched in dignified silence as the ship sailed past them. But there was nothing dignified about the little Adelies. They were so friendly they would flop down on their bellies and toboggan along, pushing with their feet and croaking what sounded like, "Clark! Clark!" Especially, it seemed, if Robert Clark, the gaunt and taciturn Scottish biologist, happened to be at the wheel. In spite of the disappointing progress, they celebrated Christmas festively. The wardroom was decorated with bunting, and they had an excellent dinner of soup, herring, jugged hare, plum pudding, and sweets, washed down with stout and rum. Afterward, there was a hearty songfest, with Hussey playing a one-stringed violin he had made himself. That night, before he turned in, Greenstreet recorded the day's events in his diary, concluding the entry with these words: "Here endeth another Christmas day. I wonder how and under what circumstances our next one will be spent. Temperature, 30 degrees. He would have been shocked, could he have guessed. But the coming of the new year of 1915 brought some changes in the pack. Sometimes they were hemmed in on all sides by dense, hummocky old floes.